Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And as you know, I usually talk to internet entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. But a Mixergy fan sent me an email and linked me over to a video of this entrepreneur, and he said, you've got to meet him. Justin Petticoat is the guy who introduced us. And he said, Joe Herron is the guy that you need to talk to. You need to have him on here. He's not an internet entrepreneur, but his story is so electrifying, and the way that he delivers it is just motivating. And Joe, I've got you on here because I saw that news report with you, and I said, I've got to go and build an even bigger business. That's how much you got me all fired up. So let me introduce you to the audience, and then we'll take them through your story so they could get the same kind of energy from you. You're a man who you now run Crispin Cider Company, and we'll talk about what that is. And before that, you launched a soda company, Nutrisoda, in a world where I thought we had all the sodas that we can use. You come out there, you launched a new company, and you sold it to PepsiCo, am I right?
To Pepsi Americas, yes.
Okay.
So, what would you like to know about Nutrisoda?
How about we do just a quick, so people understand what you're doing now, before we go back in history, just a quick understanding of what Crispin Cider Company is.
Sure. Why don't I just give you a little bit of background about me first. I'm South African, living in Minneapolis. I've lived here for 9 years, and everyone went left and we went right, and it's minus 20 degrees Celsius today, so a lot different to where I grew up. I started my career in advertising and then joined Bristol Myers, who were my client, and was started on a journey across the world with my family. I'm married with two children, and went to live in the UK for 5 years, and during that time I joined the Swiss pharmaceutical company called Novartis, and we lived in Sweden for 18 months and were then transferred to the US, to Minneapolis, to run the medical nutrition business. And I'm giving you the information as to kind of how we started Nutrisoda, because I was running a medical nutrition company which essentially was nutritional intervention for sick people. So taking nutrients and helping people get well, get better. And my wife came up with an idea about an immune drink for people who fly a lot. So I went, wow, that's a really cool idea. And because of the business I was in, I thought, well, there's an opportunity to make something that really works, as opposed to adding pixie dust and just putting enough nutrients in it to almost make a claim, but not quite. And so we came up with this idea of a nutrient-enhanced soda. It started off with an immune drink for people who fly a lot. We never sold to one airline, and it turned into this drink that, you know, moms really liked and kids really liked, because it was cool and hip, and it was in an 8-ounce can, and Red Bull had launched, and it created a space in the soda business where you could charge $1.99 a can. So you could actually pay and cover the cost of the nutrients, making a reasonable margin. And, you know, I think, you know, one of the, if you're going to want a lesson, I think there needs to be an inherent level of stupidity in every entrepreneur, because the cleverer you are, the more analysis you do and the less risk you take. And, you know, entrepreneurs manage opportunity, they don't manage risk. And going into the soda business on the surface is kind of dumb. But if you can find an available space, then why not? And the available space at that time was health and wellness was a big trend. Obesity was a trend. And Red Bull had created, you know, a pricing model. And vitamin water had started to talk about, you know, vitamin and enhanced waters. And so the soda space, which was a little more frivolous, a little more fun, was available and vacant for a health and wellness type of product. And then that transferred into, you know, wellness benefits from your skin to your health.
All right. I want to dig into every bit of this, though. I want to know the whole story, how you got into it. And first of all, let me thank the people who are watching us live who told me that the audio wasn't coming in clearly. And thanks to them, I was able to figure it out. So Cover Cash, Tevi 2009, Will Lamb, thank you guys all for helping me with the audio as we're doing this live. They're coming in and helping me out. So thanks, guys. All right. So you had no history in the soda business. You had history in pharmaceuticals, but they're essentially two different worlds, aren't they?
They're completely different.
Completely different. Even if you're going to add one to the other, it's almost easier to add soda to pharmaceuticals, considering your background, than to create a soda company that happens to have nutritional benefits.
Making sodas taste good is really, really important, okay? So when you're looking at this whole concept, you're absolutely right, because people drink because they're thirsty. And that's fundamental. And if you at all interested in the beverage business, and I was, I'd become more interested in it. So being a voracious reader, I wasn't as much a beverage virgin as I thought I was.
I see. So you were reading about it, and that gave you enough of a background, you felt, to start.
Exactly. So, you start, the joke, I always call the start of a business the break in the clouds, because they tend to happen more random than people expect. The planning of new businesses is much more random than, I'm going to sit at my desk and suddenly I'm going to start a soda business. We kind of had the idea, and I started looking at it, and obviously coming through my background had, a pretty substantial strategic training. So, when we came in, what I didn't realize was that distribution was as difficult. That's the art in beverages, it's all about distribution. Making products is difficult, but it's not as hard as getting distribution.
Okay, so let's go through the story in detail here of how you did this, how you went from an idea to a product to a sale to Pepsi. So You had this idea. Did you go and just start to formulate it by yourself? Did you go back to, I think you said you were working at, I think I saw that you were working at Novartis at the time. Did you go back to Novartis and ask them for help?
No. That's not their space. It's not their interest. They're not in.
So what do? Do you go to your kitchen and you start whipping up soda? I wouldn't even know where to begin.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I think that serendipity is another underrated quality in terms of entrepreneurs. You get lucky, and Minneapolis is a great place to start a business. The six steps of separation inherently in Minneapolis are probably about two or three. So once you start networking and discussing things, you will start to build your knowledge base. And I found a fabulous partner down in Louisville, Kentucky, called ProLiquitec, who developed my formulation. So what I would do is I would get these what I call paper formulations. So I'm going to make these four products: an immune drink, and a mental alertness drink, a stress drink, and an energy drink. Those were the first four ideas.
Okay, and did you say that was the word that you used, paper formulation? So you sat down.
Formulation.
What is that?
A paper formulation is I would go through in functional nutrients that I knew would have solutions for symptomatic behavior like stress or energy And once you know those things, you can put them down. I'm particularly interested in amino acids as a functional nutrient, and one in particular called L-arginine, which has tremendous qualities from immune boosting to wound healing to, facilitating insulin receptivity and diabetes. And it's just so I knew that type of stuff, but I didn't know how to make it taste good. And by the way, so the one nutrient that I'm totally in love with tastes like crap. It's just the worst tasting thing ever.
Which one is it?
It's bitter. It's really, really difficult. And I'm in a place where I said, we've got to put 3 grams of arginine in the soda. And my partners are going, yeah, nuts, this will never work. And of course, so here's the other funny story. So we have this immune drink. What are you going to have in an immune drink? You're always going to have vitamin C. Well, vitamin C and arginine, which is a building block of protein, oxidize as dead cow, literally. So one of the prototypes came in, you opened the can, and it literally smelt of dead cow. So a dead cow soda. And, so you have to go through those things. I knew the flavor houses would help me on formulating. And this is a pretty important lesson for anybody that's interested in a beverage business, but or any kind of business, a lot of big guys will always help you. And the way that they work is they, in exchange for the formulation, which you sell as your product, they have exclusive rights to supplying you the ingredients and the flavor keys and all of that.
I see. So in the beverage industry, you're saying that there's something called a flavor house. You go to them, they help you formulate the flavor, but they then have to be your exclusive supplier to that flavor. So they have an interest in doing this. How did you even know that these guys existed? If I were going to start a beverage business, I'd have no clue that there was a beverage house.
I knew from Novartis, and I knew because in my original job at Bristol Myers, I was in the personal care division, which had a big deodorant business in South Africa. And deodorant, the way that it's used in Africa is very different to the US. US is all about functionality, don't perspire, no wetness, to summarize what it is. In South Africa, which is less affluent, the mass population use it as a cologne, as a status symbol. I smell good, which means I'm a person of a certain level of sophistication.
Oh, wait, let me see if I understand this. You're saying that where was it in the world that people perspire and they love the smell of it?
No, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is I was in the deodorant business, and I'm just implying the context of deodorants. Deodorants in the US is about not perspiring, not being wet. In South Africa, which is a less affluent background, people use it as a cologne. And so I was involved with developing quite heavily scented deodorants with these fragrance houses, who are also, by the way, the flavor houses. So the same molecular chemistry that's used in fragrances is used in food. And so I knew about these guys and how they worked. But I found a small guy in Louisville called Pro Liquitec, and Dave Defoe, who's now a very good friend of mine, he said, Joe, you're going to get the big guys. I'm going to do this for you because you've got a great idea. But no one will do it better than us. No one will make these ingredients taste better, and also no one will give you more support. And if you're looking, as a startup, it's an isolated business. Most people that are probably watching now know. And the more support you get from partners and friends and family, the better. So Dave developed the formula from my paper formula and made them taste terrific. So that's how you get a product.
Okay, so you knew about the flavor houses. They helped you create your product. You insisted on having nutrients in there that were going to make your soda taste or smell at least like a dead cow, rotting cow. But you worked it out with them. They helped you include just enough of the nutrients that you needed so that you could feel proud of the product and also make it taste good enough that people actually drink it without vomiting.
And they never smell like dead cow. It tasted like tangerine and lime was the flavor in it. So, and masking nutrients is very much so. If you have a bitter product, you would tend to mask it within a bit of framework. So lime and tangerine citrus flavors work that way.
Okay. And guys, if you're watching this live, let me know what the audio is sounding like now. Is it coming in clearly? Are you able to follow what we're saying? Any feedback that you can give me would be helpful. Okay. All right, so now you've got the product. In fact, before we get to the product, did you write a business plan for this before you started out?
Of course. Everyone writes a business plan because it makes them feel really busy and useful and all of that. When the business plan, the five-year business plan changes every 5 minutes. So, yes, I think you have to write a business plan. I think you have to understand the context of where it's going to go and what it's going to be. You obviously need a business plan to raise money.
How in-depth was your business plan? Was it the kind of thing that we see when we look at business plan books with an executive summary, an analysis of the competition, analysis of the opportunities, the five-year projections of income, et cetera? It was.
Yeah, you have to do that. And then you would do an ROI and an internal rate of return. All of those things need to be out there. I think they're all bullshit, but you have to do them. And you have to have some level of direction and some level of the guardrails of what your business can be, not least of which is how much margin are you going to make relative to each product that you sell? How much is it going to cost you to make it? How much? What's the price going to be? And what do you use with that gross margin? You know, those are the important parameters. Whether the numbers are accurate is moot.
I see. So the exactness of the numbers, that's the bullshit part. But it seems like you're saying you were helped by the process because it helped you understand where you were going, helped you really get a sense of where your profit margins were, what your business was about or going to be about. Am I understanding it right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
If you don't understand that, you're going to sell product at a loss.
And did you raise money?
We did.
How much?
We raised about $2 million in the end.
$2 million?
Yeah.
From who?
You know, we raised it from friends and family and angel investors. This is a very good city for angel investment. It's a city that has a strong entrepreneurial flair, you know, from Aveda through Tonka Toys to Aussie Shampoo to 3M and an entire medical device community. So I always say that there's, you know, raising capital, you have to understand the concentric circles. So there tends to be groups. So in Minneapolis, you have the old money that's born out of the Cargill, General Mills kind of families and that side. You have a lot of medical device people with wealth who have invested or started medical device companies. And then, you know, so we were very connected, and we were fortunate enough to have a strong connection in the Jewish community of Minneapolis, who was in the beverage business. So the Phillips family, who started Belvedere Vodka, and Dean Phillips was one of our early investors and board members, and so that network started that way.
See, the South African Jewish community is pretty tight from what I can see. You go into a synagogue, you see that they're connected with each other, they talk business unapologetically, and there's a closeness that happens, true?
Well, one, I'm not Jewish, so I don't really know the South African Jewish community other than my friends, but the Minneapolis Jewish community is certainly similar to that. It's very tight-knit, very collegial, very entrepreneurial. And that was a huge benefit for us. The lesson is this: it's you'll get into one network. You know, trying to raise money across a million places is very hard. You'll spend all your time spending raising money versus selling product, and you only make money selling boxes. The more boxes you sell, the more money you make. So, you know, honestly, I think a lot of successful startups are just plain lucky. They have a great idea at a great time, and then they get the breaks that you need. We got a lot of breaks through geography. It's almost, I don't know if anybody's read Malcolm Gladwell's books. His most famous is The Tipping Point, and then Blink, and I'm reading Outliers, and it's a lot of success is circumstantial. And
do you really feel that? I mean, as a guy who's worked so hard, do you feel that it was circumstantial more than hard work?
You don't get successful not working hard. I mean, I think that's a given. I think that's just, you have to work very, very hard at what you do. But your circumstances play a role in your success and the speed of your success. So, you know, I think being in Minneapolis was a circumstance that was unusual. I mean, sometimes especially like this morning, I'm wondering, how on earth did I ever get from South Africa to Minneapolis? But so those circumstances played to my advantage. It's a big consumer goods culture, from Target to Best Buy to Super Value, the big retail chains, to very strong, you know, branded, you know, consumer goods brands that were developed, like General Mills, you know, like Aveda, like Tonka Toys.
Let me push a little harder or deeper into what I've understood so far. So you raised money through these connections.
Yes.
How did you convince them that they should bank on you, that you're the guy to run a new soda company when you haven't had the background in the space?
You know, it's probably that's an excellent question, because I think angel investors invest in two things. They invest in the idea, you know, that's what you invest, and they invest in the execution. And the execution is through who's starting the business. And so I think I have a good creative vision about what products are and how they should be packaged. And you and I had an earlier discussion. I'm very interested in space versus place. So a market, a vacant market space, a space that's available for exploitation through innovation, nutrient-enhanced sodas, or, you know, hard apple cider that you drink over ice, or those kind of things. Once you've got that idea, I only talk about execution. How are we going to make it real? And I think people have always seen that the ideas are good, but the focus on making them real and executing, you know, very, very solidly is what people invest in me for. So that's how you persuade them on idea, person, and the return. You know what, you know, who's going to buy it? And, you know, so if you're in the business of starting businesses to sell, then you need to know who's going to buy it. You know, who is in the business. And, you know, Coca-Cola and Pepsi are particularly acquisitive in terms of new beverages. It's a good.
So you built this business with the idea that you were going to sell it to Coke, to Pepsi, to one of the majors.
That was the idea on Nutrisoda for sure.
Okay. Let's go back to what we talked about last night in our conversation about this in preparation. It sounds to me like what you do is you look for an opportunity to build something that the majors couldn't get into because they don't have the R&D, they don't have the time. You're building with the idea that you're eventually going to sell to them, to outsource almost their R&D and their risk taking.
That was certainly the part of the concept of Nutrisoda. I'm not so sure that's the smartest idea, by the way, to have. I think the difference with people who build companies to sell and people who build companies to do well are quite different. So I think that we were fortunate on Nutrisoda, but Crispin has been built differently. Crispin learned a lot from Nutrisoda in terms of, you know, find vacant space, execute well, get your distributors the tools they need, focus on selling boxes. But I would say that the opportunity in space, other than there is clearly flip opportunities, is also it's less competitive. You know, Budweiser don't have a cider. That makes it a lot easier for me to play because they're not going to come and crush me with a huge price differential.
I see.
Do you see what I mean? So there's two parts to the thing. Yeah, and I'm using Anheuser-Busch and InBev as an example. Because I'm not in their space and we've gone out and the concept is proven. You've got to a certain level of sales. You know, they've researched and seen cider is a growing category. It's growing faster than craft beer even. Well, let's have a conversation. And my wife says, no, I don't want to have a conversation.
They don't want to have a conversation about buying
no,
you?
I'm laughing. My wife and I have a joke. She says, please don't sell this business because then you're going to start another one. I don't want to do it again.
Why? How many hours are you working now on this new business?
You know,
what's the strain on her?
You're asking great questions, by the way. I actually used to work a lot harder at Novartis than I work in startups. Startups are inherently a bit easier because you don't have a million meetings and you don't have a million emails and you don't have a million conference calls. You're really focused on just doing what has to be done. The biggest issue is the dreaming. Your job just never stops. And you will know, Andrew, you dream about Mixergy. And so feeling rested and getting a balanced life is not an option. It's not about the work, it's about being consumed, that every time I drink something, every time I go to a restaurant, every time I look at, you know, a book or something or magazine, I'm just I'm just thinking about CRISPN all day long, and that's the issue. But the work is much more balanced than major corporations where everyone has the power to say no, but very few people have the power to say yes.
I see. I know what you mean. You really just never let it go. In the middle of the night, you wake up almost doing your job, and then you realize, no, I'm asleep. But your body, your mind thinks that it's doing the job. Or you wake up with worries, or you wake up with, what am I going to do tomorrow? How am I going to invent the future the next day?
Exactly. So, yeah, and I think that takes a particular character. It takes a particular character to lose the safety net where, you know, hey, if this fails, you've gone. And so the risk reward, you know, a lot of people, and I've had a lot of friends who have said, I'm going to start a business. But guess what? They wanted this old salary, their old benefits.
You know what, though? If I'm reading your background right, you waited a while before you took that plunge. You had the safety, and it wasn't until later in life that you became an entrepreneur, no?
Yeah, I mean, we started Nutrisoda probably 2003, 18th of April, or May 2003, something like that. So, yeah, I was pretty old. If you look at the data, most businesses are started by, and this is this excludes cyber entrepreneurs, which are much, much younger and have always skewed younger than that. But if you look at fast-moving consumer goods and typical consumer goods, people start between their late 30s and mid-40s. That's kind of the age. 35 to 45 is the most fertile time. And I think there's a function of a couple of things. One, you might have saved up enough money to be able to, you know, to cover the year or so that it takes to actually get it off the ground, because it's going to take a year. From idea to putting a product on the shelf is going to take you a year. It might be 2 months less or 2 months more, but it's going to take you a year. And then you've also got the experience to evaluate what opportunity is. You know, what is a real opportunity? Because I do talks to people and students at business school and about entrepreneurships, and it's an interesting question. So you ask a group of about 40, 50 kids, and you say, so who wants to start their own business? And everyone puts both hands up in the air. I want to do it. Okay. Why do you want to start your own business? I want to be my own boss. Well, that's bollocks, eh? You always work for someone because, you know, you're going to have a boss. So discount those people. And ideas are like T-shirts. Everyone has T-shirts. Real business ideas are very hard to make. They take a lot of sacrifice. They involve not only hard work, but sacrificing all the things that you get from a big company, like a job, like medical benefits, like a car. Those don't happen.
And you sacrifice it for what? Why?
Oh, you place a bet. You go on black. Oh, black, 18 black. You put your number on, you say, it's going to land. And I reckon it's going to land because I've got inside information, which is this. People are much more predisposed to being healthy. They're looking for a refreshing drink, but they'd really choose a refreshing Nutrisoda over a refreshing Coca-Cola with a lot of high fructose corn syrup. So that's the inside bet. That's what you place on. You know something that no one else does, and you're going to go out and make the bet.
I see. Okay. And for me, too.
That doesn't mean it's going to land on 17 red.
Yes, you're right. It could end up landing on 17 red. For me, too, it's the unlimited upside. That I know that if I were going to go work at a job, I could pretty much see where my life was going to be 10 years from now. But if I go out there and start a company as an entrepreneur, it's unlimited. There are no fences. It's as far as I'm willing to keep going and as far as I can see. For you,
you know, for me it's a little different. I think I'm a creative person in an extremely untalented body. So I can't play a guitar. I can't paint, and I think that my gift is I can see the space. like Wayne Gretzky, and it's become a cliche and a horrible cliche. Gretzky would watch where the puck would skate to where the puck was going as opposed to where it was now. I think because I've spent so much time being interested in thinking about business and ideas, that this is my creative expression. This is what I do. This makes me happy. I really get happy. Whereas I ran an almost $400 million business with 700 employees, including a factory, and I literally loathed that job to distraction, and I hated it. It didn't make me happy. So my creative expression comes through doing this. My adrenaline comes through, I'm sitting in a bar on Wednesday night and I sit down and I order my own drink, because, you know, that's what you do. And the guy two seats down was drinking Crispin. There you go. And then a guy sat next to me and ordered a Crispin. The bartender said, I didn't set it up. It happened actually. So that's an incredibly fulfilling moment, that you actually made something that people like, that you don't even know who they are. There's a significant fulfillment. And a lot, I don't know how many people are watching, whatever, but I would tell everybody, every entrepreneur out there, if you're doing it for money, you're gonna get creamed. You're not gonna make any money. If you're doing it because it makes you happy, you got a real shot.
Why does it work that way? And by the way, I don't know if I asked you in the beginning what Crispin cider was. I don't know if we explained it. It's hard apple cider that you drink on ice. True?
Correct.
Okay. All right. We'll get into. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, go on.
Why is it that the people who are out there to make money as entrepreneurs are the ones who are going to fail? You would think that if they set financial goals for themselves and they drove every day to get to those goals, then they'd make it. That's what you'd think it's all about, isn't it? To be clear about where you're going and to work hard to get there. And if the dollar amount is what you're aiming for, then you've got a very clear target to wake up and charge towards. Why do you think that doesn't work?
Well, I think pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered.
What do you mean by that?
I think that people who have money as their overriding ambition are going to make different decisions, make different sacrifices, which typically can be and the antithesis of what it takes to succeed. And so, you know, being greedy, I'll give you an example. So we sold Nutrisoda for what for us was quite a lot of money. What for some was not enough money, but, you know, we prevailed. I'm not going to tell you.
Can you give me just a ballpark? Just I don't need the exact number.
Double figure millions.
Double figure millions. Okay, so you got $2 million in investment. We're talking about 10 to 20 million in sale.
Correct. In 2 years.
In 2 years.
In 18 months.
In 18 months. But you told us earlier that it was 12 months from idea to launch. Does
that okay.
So
12 months to go, 18 months to sell. And it's totally fortunate, totally lucky, totally blessed. That's just not realistic.
Let me see if I understand this right, though. It's 18 plus 12 months?
Yes.
Okay.
30 months.
All right, let me go deeper. I see you lost my camera. There, it's back. Let's go back to the beginning just so I get a clearer understanding. One of the reasons that I kill a lot of the motivational talks and the motivational air of my interviews is that I get so curious about the details that I don't give us an opportunity to talk about how great life can be and you know, get into the motivational stuff that you hear in locker rooms before a football game. But I am what I am, and I got to get into the details here. So we got into how you came up with the formulation for the product. We got into details about how you raised money for it. What I didn't get to ask you about, though, is where did you go for customers first?
Okay, so this is how there's a step that you've missed, because once you've got a formulation, you have to find somebody to make it.
Okay.
Okay, and so we found a co-packer through our partners, and we got a co-packer in Wisconsin, and then we moved the co-packing responsibilities to Minnesota. So we've got all the products, we make it, and the way that it works in any consumer goods product, you'll never get any distribution until you have a product. People want to taste it, look at the packaging, look at everything. So we got all of that together, and then we had to find distribution. So The era of retailing in the US has changed pretty dramatically over the last 15 years. The biggest change is Walmart gets increasingly powerful, and then a whole subset of retailers invented ways to compete with Walmart. And typically there was two parts to that. One is a big one called Target, which democratizes design and makes it cool and hip to go and shop for clothes and some food in the supermarket. That's one part. The other part is a whole slew of independent grocers who realize that they'll never compete in price and they have to compete on service delivery, but that service delivery proposition is inherent in great products, the cool shit that you'll never find in a Walmart. So gourmet sodas, gourmet sauces, gourmet food, great fresh produce, all of that. So that business is serviced in particular by a distribution channel called the gourmet distributors, and the independent distributor. Kehi is a big one in Chicago. In the natural food channel, have a distributor called UNFI. And then on the East Coast, they have a lot of these guys. That was our distribution model. We went after those guys before we went to the bottling system, before we went to beverage distributors, and got in and got on the shelf and got on the shelf of these cool, hip grocers. And that's how we started selling.
Did you know them before you started the company well enough that you could bank on them? No, you just knew that you could create a product that they'll probably like.
Exactly.
But you knew of them before.
Yeah. Actually, truthfully, no.
You didn't even know of them. You just knew that there was a potential.
I was just lucky and just me talking to people through my network, through my allies. I mean, we got one food and we got one wine and spirits distributors. They were our first distributor. They were like the anti-distributor. They had so many products. But a friend of ours got us in, and it didn't work. But as you learn those things, you learn your options, and we got in, and then the other big distinction is as Walmart, Target, Walgreens, you know, Costco have got more powerful, you can go direct. And so, but to go direct, if anybody's listening and wants to know, you can't call Target as much as you think you can and ask for an appointment to see the beverage buyer. You'll never get through. You'll never know if you're talking to the right guy because they change a lot. You never know, you know, so you need a broker. And so in the US, getting as a small company, your system of access model is built on three stools. You, the retailer, it's actually three stools excluding you. The broker, the retailer, and the distributor who puts it on his truck and gets it there. And so you have to manage all of that. And that we learned, and hopefully I'm helping somebody that's online now, streaming it. That's extremely important to know, because ideas and products without access are PowerPoint presentations. They're nothing. So the whole, and so with Crispin, you know, I thought I knew something, and I knew a bit. I knew enough to know that I had to go into the beer distribution system. Okay, so we're in the beer distribution system here, and we sell to guys who are selling Miller, you know, Guinness, those type of products, and we spend 80% of all of our resources on that.
I'm talking to them and getting them to take your stuff out.
Every day, every single day. That is. And I would say for any consumer goods model, your access model is your most critical obstacle. The idea, no matter how brilliant it is, if it doesn't get on a shelf, is just an idea.
Did you know that before you got into the beverage industry?
I didn't know that enough when I got into Nutrisoda. So I'm hoping to alleviate some pain for some guy or girl with a great idea, that if they don't know that, it's really, really hard. So spend a lot of time finding out how you get to market. What's the
I would
best?
think that you'd spend more time thinking about the product, a little less, but also a lot of time thinking about the packaging and the customer. But the distribution just wouldn't occur to me. And I remember reading the book by the guys who started the Brooklyn Brewery, who ran into the same problem. They had no clue. Did you read that book? Do you know their story?
I don't, but I love Brooklyn Brew beer. It's just great. I think it's terrific. Great beer and certainly inspirational to me. So,
So you got to the gourmet distributors. They're the ones who took you into the stores, and they're the ones who essentially sold your product to the people who would end up giving you access to the consumer.
okay. Remember I told you about circumstance?
Yes.
Now, I live in Minneapolis. My first customer was Target. And
Ooh.
so circumstantially, Target is an incredibly creative retailer. Okay, they're the ones that are looking for mass market ideas that are cooler, newer, and more innovative. So Target were my first customer, and we could deliver to Target. And so the next time I went to a distributor or to a customer, I said, "We're in Target." They went, "Wow, oh, okay. We'll give you a go
So
to
how'd
see
you get
what
into Target?
broker, best broker of all time."
And he
Just
just, why was he so good to you? What was it about your relationship with him?
I don't know, my job. I don't know.
Okay.
He
All
liked
right.
me.
Listen to me. I
He
get
liked
down into all the details.
He liked me. He liked the product. He knew his buyer well enough to know that the buyer would give me a shot. And I'll tell you another thing about Target. Target's, you got to be cool, you got to be hip, but there's one thing that counts at Target. You got to deliver. It's very difficult to deliver. Walmart is the same. They're not going to be screwing around for the small, cool idea that can't fit in their system. So that's where a broker can really help you. In terms of your distribution model, how it's going to go, how you're going to get it there, how you're going to get it to them,
To make sure you could keep supplying them.
it's not only that. It's not about being out of stock. It's unique barcodes on shippers, on outer packs, and there's a complexity that one. And Target will train you. You go in, you spend 2 days with them. They'll train you how to do that.
What am I supposed to make of this? Of all my notes here, I see luck coming up over and over in our conversation in my notes. What is the person who's listening to us right now, who's hungry to achieve something in the world? What are we supposed to make of just luck? How do we can't make our own luck. Does that mean that we should just work hard
Oh,
and hope things work out?
I think you make your own luck. I mean,
So how do we
that
make our own luck?
by working hard. I mean, it sounds stupid and it sounds dumb, but okay. So everyone is wanting. It's all about if you're going to start a business and you're going to risk everything you own, and you have to have this idea that has a better shot than most of being successful. You're betting on 18 black because you know underneath you know something. And we had the discussion about market space versus marketplace. Market space is available, relatively uncontested space. Marketplace is doing another flavored water, another functional water, another energy drink, another flavored vodka, whatever, which is so many people, how do you cut through and make through? That's not luck. That's being smart, and that's thinking strategically about opportunity. Okay, just blind luck is not the same thing as luck. Okay, they're not the same thing, and activity is not the same thing as productivity. So spending a huge amount of time on the packaging and all, which is all important, critical, it still might not be as productive as really working hard on finding your space, exploiting the space well, being fast and messy, getting in there first before everybody else came in. So you might be changing packaging. I mean, we went through three iterations of Nutrisoda packaging in the first year. One didn't make it, one made it, and then we did the third one, which changed everything. But we were fast and we kept doing
What do you
it.
change based on? I know online we change based on data as it comes in from users, and we could do A/B testing and instantly know which design works better than the other. How do you in the offline world know that?
Well, it's about being aware and listening, huh? So, and that sounds obvious, but if you, I mean, we're about, so we've had Crispin on the market for a year, and we're about to refresh it now, and it's become a little bit more masculine, a little less wine-like. You know, these are just things that we do because we do a lot of demos, a lot of tastings, so we're listening all the time, we're talking to people all the time. The data points are less, I mean, unless you're big and you're General Mills or Kellogg's or Nestle and you can go out and spend a lot of money on market research, ours is in market research, it's on the ground research, it's talking to people research.
When you say talking to people, do you mean going into stores and talking to them, or are you bring them in for focus groups?
Usually they're at events. You know, so we're now in the beer fest, wine fest, food and wine festival thing. That's when you're talking to people that are probably screened a little bit. They're interested in it. They're typically quite educated. They're typically very interested in the category. That's why they're there. So you can get good information there. And you know, most of us actually, if we've done enough work on the idea in the beginning. So for me, I'll tell you how Crispin came about. So my really good friend Scott is English, and he came over for summer, and we're having a barbecue, and he said, "Well, Joe, do you drink cider?" And, you know, he's my age, so we know. Mao says, "No, I don't drink cider. I don't drink sweet beer. I like beer. I don't want really something that's for people who don't really like beer." And they just, and I've grown up in the British colonies where cider is what you drink when you didn't like alcohol. Like Smirnoff Ice is today, that's what cider was then. So, no. He said, "Well, in the UK, you know, we're drinking it over ice." I went, "Oh, okay. Very interesting." So now I have a reason, a very good reason for someone to consider cider when they didn't have a very good reason before. So I started to talk about that and discuss it. Intuitively, cider over ice worked for me. I could get it.
Why? So, yeah. Why? It seems, at first, it could seem like beer over ice. It seems strange. Why did cider over ice hit you differently?
Well, because it's not beer to me. It's like alcoholic apple wine, sparkling apple wine, and the sparkling side just sounded like they could work. Whereas beer, you know, the context of beer over ice didn't work. Intuitively, to me, it didn't work, and it's exploded the cider market globally. It's
cider over ice. Just the addition of ice exploded it.
Now remember one thing. So the beer business has changed dramatically through what I call the serving ritual. So Guinness has a slow pour. Okay, but what is Corona? It's weak beer that you drank with a lime. Bang! Big success. What is Blue Moon? A wannabe Belgian beer that, bang, you drink it with an orange. What is Stella? It's an average lager that, bang, you drink it in a Belgian chalice. The serving ritual is everything in the beer business. So suddenly I have a serving ritual of cider over ice and a cool glass and all of those things. Now I've got a whole ritual that I can start to get people to reconsider it, and it is refreshing. Then I had to go and look at the market, and the cider market here is very sweet beer oriented. The brands are very much beer alternatives for people who don't really like beer, which was not for me. So we developed something with more sophistication in terms of flavor profile. It's dry and it's crisp. So now I'm creating all this space in the category. It's a different serving ritual, it's a different flavor profile, it's a different packaging concept. It's all moving apart. So that's kind of how I create space.
I see. Okay. So now, instead of going head to head against the majors in the beer business, you're creating a whole other category. And so you don't have to battle them. You just have to be on your own. But from what I remember, even from elementary marketing in college, when you have a brand new product in a brand new category, you have to really train the audience. You have to train people to understand it. You have to teach them what the product is, how it works with ice. That's a lot of money and time, no?
Yes.
And how do you do it now?
Well, we spend a lot of time and money. do we spend as much money as you know, Anheuser-Busch, InBev, and launching Bud Light Wheat? No. But do we spend as much time and effort going into a bar and getting people to try it? Do we do cider dinners where people associate our brand with great food and great innovation? Yeah, we do that. We do much, much more work on an experiential marketing basis than on a mass consumer basis.
With the idea that you're now doing these dinners, the people there will try out your drink in a new way, and then they'll take it home and introduce it to their friends at their dinners, or if they're out at a bar, they'll show exactly. their friends how to drink. How do you target these influentials? How do you get the right people?
Well, there's the most important part is being is what we call on-premise. So bars, restaurants is where you go, because that's where you can illustrate that consumption moment, that serving ritual. Plus, if you choose, you're starting to segment by choosing cool bars, cool restaurants. We're very interested in neighborhood restaurants in cool neighborhoods, as opposed to, you know, big expensive restaurants. I'd much rather be talking to people more like you and me, where we like good food, but we want it to be more novel, more creative, and those things. We want to go into good bars where people really like to be and have fun. That's our TV medium. Our TV medium is the bar and the restaurant.
I see. All right, let's go back real quick to Nutrisoda. Mm-hmm. How did you connect with I say Pepsi, but it's Pepsi USA?
Pepsi Americas. Which is the second biggest bottling group. It's a listed company. Well, again, I go back to luck. So I live in Minneapolis. The Polat family own, you know, the biggest individual shareholders in Pepsi Americas and run it. Bob Polat runs it. And they were looking, if you're a bottler in a Pepsi system and you're a publicly traded company, you're very dependent on PepsiCo. The products that PepsiCo give to you to sell and the channels that you sell. So it's a pretty finite proposition. As Pepsi go, you go. And they were looking at how could they grow the bottling business so that it gained a little more independence from the mothership. And this was a great test. They'd seen that it had done very well in their markets. And you know, we had developed a lot of our model here that they could take into their markets. So that's how that happened.
I see. And for when I post this, can I say 15 or so million dollars, or is that?
Don't say any money.
Don't say any money. Okay.
Yeah.
The big money brings the headlines in, which brings people to come and watch us.
No, rather it's quality, not quantity.
I'm gonna say how an entrepreneur lucked into luck that led to something lucky.
There you go.
we're always modest as entrepreneurs.
I don't know what people are expecting to hear from me.
No, they've heard a lot here that's going to be useful. I'm teasing because luck comes up over and over in my interviews with entrepreneurs, and not a single self-improvement author has said, hey, you know what? Luck plays a part. They never will acknowledge even a little bit of luck that goes into it. So I want to understand what part it really plays, and I think it's somewhere between nothing and everything. And I'm trying to figure out where exactly.
I'd really go grab that book, Outliers, by Malcolm Gladwell. I mean, he's a populist writer, and he writes popular, psychology and. God bless him, because he's done extraordinarily well at simplifying some pretty complex concepts, and he's well read and well researched. So I really found it interesting. He takes all of these things, so he will say something like, so they went and analyzed the most successful ice hockey players, professional ice hockey players. Well, guess what? They're all born in the first 3 months of the year. And those that are born in January are more successful. Those born in February, which are more successful in March, which are much more successful than the kids born in December. Why? They had 10 months more development, 10 months more physical maturity. That's circumstance. That's pure luck.
When they're younger, and they're playing, they're the oldest kids in their grade, so that they do better, which means that the coaches spend more time on them, which means that they do even better. And by the time they get older, they're unstoppable compared to the kids who are younger and smaller. Which means, yes.
Yeah, you're in. You're gonna. I can see you in the NFL right now.
No, what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna hold my kid back before going to kindergarten 5 years till he's the biggest kid in kindergarten. Then he'll dominate. He'll get all the support from the coaches. He'll be in the NFL for me.
I'm sure there are gonna be parents that are doing this, holding their kids back. So, it is luck, but you do make your own luck. There is a difference between blind luck and being lucky. And, you know, fortune favors the brave is the flip side of that coin. Just, you know, be stupid, but don't do stupid things. These are things that, you know, and South Africans, by the way, are very given to aphorisms. The African culture is about stories and how we describe these things. And the chairman of South African Breweries is a really, really interesting man and a very direct, blunt man. And he said, business is like a wheelbarrow. You have to pick it up to move it. And I would say that's kind of really true to the heart of what you're doing with Mixergy, what we're doing with Crispin. Just pick it up. Don't look at it and say, geez, I built this brilliant wheelbarrow. What a fabulous wheelbarrow. Pick it up. It's not going to move unless you pick it up.
What I think that's a great place to end it, but I'm still going to push with just a little bit more here. What are you doing online? What's your online social media basic web strategy? I know that you've got a new site that launched, right?
We have a new site. For us, we probably spend more time on our web. We spend as much time on the web as we do on sampling, which means we spend almost all of our time doing those things. So it's clear, I mean, this is obvious. Everyone should have a website, but what is less obvious is everyone should have a website that you can change every day and update and give useful information and useful tools. So that's the fundamentally where business is changing is how Facebook and Twitter change your sales force.
So how are you integrating them into your business?
We have Twitter. Twitter we use functionally to tell people about stuff we're doing. We don't tell them anything more than, hey, we've got samplings, we're available here. We use it as a directional tool. Facebook we use as an emotional tool that says, and it's about connecting with people who really like Crispin and using them to say, hey, we've got this event, or we had this event, or hey, guess what? The new Crispin tap handle is coming out, and you got some inside information. So Facebook's much more emotional, Twitter's much more directional, and the web's much more informational. Those are the three pillars of our web strategy.
Okay. All right. If anyone out there, I know that a lot of people who are into social media listen to me. If anyone out there is into social media, check out their website. If you're especially a social media consultant, check out their website, check out their strategy. Let me know what you guys think of it.
Let me know what you think of it.
Yes, let Joe know. I'll introduce you to Joe so that you guys can give him some more information about what's going on in your world, since he's shared so much of what's happening in his world with us. All right, the drink you're holding up, can we see it? I've been watching you drink. It must be a fun job where you get to drink all day.
Oh, this is probably the best job I ever had.
Do you want to do a pour so we can see what it looks like? Oh, there it is.
Well, I'll just show you the bottle. That's Crispin. This is our Brut, which is an extra dry. This is this is a The glass, you can see I have it over ice. Tough job.
Yeah.
I've drunk half of it already. I'll show you some stuff.
I'd love it. While he's doing that, I'm going to thank a few people, including Will Lamb, who's always so supportive. What's
So
that?
this is a this is our tap handle, and as you can see, so we have our concept, and if you, it's easy to, somebody knows what that's about, they can read it. If you're walking into a bar, how do you tell them this is cider that you drink over ice? And so that's our tap
I
handle.
see. So the tap handle looks like ice, and that lets everybody know in there that you pour
You've
this
got to be,
over ice.
you have to make much faster, more immediate cues. This is a more of a classically inspired line, which we call the blue line. This is our Rockstar, which is the Honeycrisp, which is much more of a craft beer type, stronger, unfiltered. So now I'm starting to cover spaces in my market space. How do I start to take my space and control it more forcefully?
I see.
So.
By covering lots of different areas within this area, within the hard
I
cider.
want, one's for the beer geek and the other one's for the wine geek.
I see.
There you
All right, do you know if I could get any of this here in South America, in Buenos Aires specifically?
UPS.
UBS.
UPS.
Oh,
I'm gonna
UPS. I gotta get this UPS over to me. I've been watching you drink it, and the whole time I'm thinking, man, I'd love to go out. It's now 5:15 on a Friday. I'm saying to myself, I'd love to have one of those as I edit. All right, we'll have the
and
UPS, or when my brother comes down here to visit me, I'll have him bring some.
that'd be great.
All right,
And
and you
thank
guys who are
you.
in the US who can go out there and just buy one of these, have one, have a sip for me, and take a picture. I'd love to see what you guys do with it. I'd love to see where you are when you're enjoying a crisp and cider.
Peace.
Thank you.
See
Thank you for doing this interview with me. And hang on as I say goodbye. And thank you to everyone who's watching us and contributing to the conversation in the live broadcast. And to all of you in advance who are going to come back to Mixergy and give me your feedback on this interview. And do what Justin did by introducing me to Joe. Introduce me to the best entrepreneurs you know so I can interview them here on Mixergy and have them teach us what they've learned as they built their business. Joe, thank you very much. Everyone, thank you. And I'll see you all in the comments.